Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we look at the future of the farm worker movement in California in advance of an event taking place tomorrow in Fresno at the Fresno Art Museum. It's a production of Cal Humanities. We'll also talk about the future of the Fresno Philharmonic as the orchestra is about to introduce new candidates for the position of music director and conductor. And what does the announcement that the state is going to spend $70 million on new projects in Fresno as part of the cap and trade program mean for the Valley? We'll get the inside scoop from our own Jeffrey Hess. Right now, though, we turn our attention to another element of the state's plan to combat global warming. Governor Brown has made it a big priority for California. One of the most recent laws he signed was Senate Bill 32, which requires the state to dramatically reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. Called critical and far-reaching, it's been heralded by some as one of the most ambitious climate regulations in the world. But not everyone thinks the law is a good thing. FM 89's Carrie Klein reports from the South Valley.
Joey Eroso has two kids and close to 3,000 mouths to feed. He's a dairy farmer in rural Tulare County.
Come on.
3,000 cows produce a lot of milk, but they also produce a lot of poop. At the end of each lane of cows, there's a big water spigot for cleaning the manure out.
This is what we'd call a manual flush system. We do it twice a day, and then it basically runs that water that comes out of the chiller system and it flushes this lane.
That slurry of water and manure drains into large open lagoons, where the solid manure settles out and the water is eventually used for irrigation. But Eroso won't be able to flush his lanes out for much longer. That's because lagoons release methane, one of the main targets of new climate legislation from Governor Jerry Brown. Under Senate Bill 32 and a few companion bills, which Brown signed into law earlier this month, California will have to cut its greenhouse gas emissions practically in half by the year 2030. Methane is a greenhouse gas that's many times more potent than carbon dioxide and it poses health risks as a precursor to other pollutants. Unfortunately for dairy farmers, cows happen to produce methane, a lot of it. So this law is bad news, and complying with it could require extensive renovations that many dairy farmers can't afford. Eroso says the message from Governor Brown is pretty clear.
What I'm hearing, he doesn't want dairy farms in California. He may not want ag in California. This has riled people up about as much as anything, and frankly, it's like getting kicked in the teeth.
Eroso is a fourth-generation dairy farmer in Pixley. He produces milk with his wife, his parents, and his 29-year-old son. The family still owns the farm his great-grandfather bought in the 1930s, along with a bigger, more efficient operation they built 10 years ago. When it's milking time, the cows walk onto what looks like a slow-moving, high-tech carousel.
This is called a rotary milking parlor. Takes about 8 minutes to make a turn. We milk about 400 cows an hour.
Each cow produces 20 to 30,000 gallons of milk per year, all of which Eroso sells to the dairy company Land O'Lakes. Close to 2 million cows graze in California, over 80% of which are in the San Joaquin Valley. And those cows produce methane from both ends. Manure is a problem in lagoons like Eroso's, where the manure solids ferment underwater without exposure to air. But cows burp methane, too. They produce it in their first stomach, where they digest grass, hay, corn husks, and other fibrous materials that most other animals can't eat. Burps and poop add up. Here's Ryan McCarthy, an advisor at the California Air Resources Board.
Well, the biggest source of methane emissions in the state, by far, are dairies. 45% of methane emissions in California come from dairies.
Manure is the largest share of that 45%, and McCarthy says that's where the Air Resources Board is focusing its methane reduction efforts.
So we're proposing to really tackle manure management at California dairies. and reduce those methane emissions from those sources by 75% by 2030.
Reducing methane could help more than the climate. Kevin Hamilton is the CEO of the Central California Asthma Collaborative, and he says methane is a precursor to some of the San Joaquin Valley's nastiest pollutants.
Methane, when it heats up and starts to split apart, is going to cause some ozone production because of the way the chemicals come back together again in the air. It's more likely to participate in also particulate matter buildup.
He says with this legislation, the state may be facing a crossroads.
Either move out the people or move the cows out, one of the two, but you're kind of in a situation where you have to consider one of the two.
He may not be far off. Back in Pixley, Eroso points to a picture of his great-grandfather's farm.
That farm there, forget it. It's not going to be adaptable to the methane regulation. The farm that was built in 1938 will not be able to operate under the regulations that he signed yesterday.
There's a possible solution, though, and it's right down the street from Eroso's farm. It's widely used in other parts of the world, and it could help the state's entire dairy industry. What it is and how it works, we'll discuss in another story. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. Today on our program, we take a closer look at the mounting debt California faces in covering public employees' pensions. As reporter Ashley Gross explains, it was during the dot-com bubble of the late 90s when the state chose to make these benefits a lot more generous. It was a decision with lasting implications.
The end of the 90s was a time when a lot of people got obsessed with the stock market.
In tonight's Moneyline Movers, cash flow up 102.38%.
And the Globe.com, which only traded one day, gained 606% on the week.
Stocks are moving and going up, 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 up.
That last voice you heard is Michael Lidke. He covers technology for the Associated Press in San Francisco.
It seemed like there was nothing, no correction. It was just like this intoxicating feeling coming across throughout the Bay Area.
Lidke says people were so excited about the internet that venture capitalists were shoveling money into e-commerce startups. And those startups spent on TV ads, showered employees with stock options, and hired big-name bands for parties. You might be wondering what the connection is between the B-52s and government worker pensions. Well, the California Public Employees Retirement System was riding high on the stock market boom. CalPERS is the largest public pension fund in the country, and it was doing so well in the stock market that state and local agencies were able to put less and less money into the fund. That, plus political change in Sacramento, opened the door to boosting pension benefits.
I was the first Democratic governor in 16 years.
Former Governor Gray Davis. He came into office with support from public sector unions. And he says when CalPERS pushed for a bill that would let state workers retire at younger ages with more money, it seemed reasonable.
Most of the people that I care about, the nurses, the firefighters, the teachers, didn't fare very well over those 16 years. So if there was a way in which I could compensate them and we could afford it, I wanted to do that.
Could the state afford it? CalPERS said yes. The agency passed around a brochure to lawmakers saying, don't worry, the burden won't fall to taxpayers. Stock market gains will cover it. Davis says he took that with a grain of salt, but overall, he thought the plan was sustainable.
When I looked at what happened in our economy over the preceding 5 years, and I got a sense of what was going to happen in Silicon Valley, it was very close to them, I really believed that we were on the doorstep of a very robust, lasting economy.
So in 1999, he signed the bill, SB 400. The new law boosted pension benefits as much as 50% for some state workers and lowered the retirement age. A highway patrol officer could call it quits at age 50. Local governments also improved their pension benefits. But of course, an economy built on companies like this.
Today, we're opening gifts from Pets.com.
Let me help. Let me help. This dog loves the holidays.
hit the skids not long after the bill was signed.
The dot-com failures continue to mount, especially...
It was the worst single-day point loss ever for both exchanges.
Public sector employees have continued to pay into the system, but with the dot-com crash and then the Great Recession, taxpayers have had to put about $90 billion into CalPERS since the year 2000. Even that hasn't been enough. The agency says it still needs more than $93 billion to strike even. Joe Nation is a professor of public policy at Stanford.
I think voters are starting to say, wait a minute, we keep raising taxes, where is it going? Well, to a great extent, it's going to public employee compensation and to pensions specifically. And I think at some point voters are going to say, mm-mm, not anymore.
Nation says one thing Californians should not count on is another stock market bubble to bail the system out. In Palo Alto, I'm Ashley Gross.
That last story is part of a series examining California's pension crisis. It's a collaboration between CalMatters, the Los Angeles Times, and our friends at Capital Public Radio. For more information on the series, it's available online at capradio.org. 2 weeks ago, the top floor of a parking garage in downtown Fresno became the unlikely center of the state's efforts to combat the effects of climate change. Governor Jerry Brown visited the site to sign several new bills that aim to reduce CO2 emissions. And it's not just about high-speed rail. In fact, a week later, the Brown administration announced that the Fresno area would receive up to $70 million in cap-and-trade funds for the new effort. Here to tell us more is Jeffrey Hess from Valley Public Radio. He was there. Jeffrey, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
So why a parking garage in downtown Fresno for the governor of California and all of these other elected leaders to join? When I got the press release, I thought, wait a second, what's going on here? That's an odd location, but not an accident, I suppose.
No, it's not an accident. And your lead-in calling it unlikely is what a lot of people who were there are saying, like, what are we doing on top of this parking garage? But really the thinking behind the Brown administration is it's overlooking a lot of what they see as green jobs, transit-oriented opportunities, clean air things that are going on. It overlooks where the high-speed rail bus depot is going to be, and it overlooks a lot of potential new growth opportunities, the Fulton Street corridor, where people can live, work, and play in kind of all the same area and do things that will reduce their climate impact via reducing carbon emissions.
So basically, the state is trying to fund developments, fund projects that will reduce the reliance on cars, essentially.
More or less.
So we're looking at this announcement 2 weeks ago, and then the next week, the mayor and Joaquin Arambula call this press conference at City Hall, and they announce this new funding thing. Exactly what did they announce? Because are specific projects getting this money at this point? What do we know about this at this stage?
Well, the specific details of it are still a little unclear. I'm going to hit you with this really awful government name for this program. The California Strategic Growth Council Transformational Climate Communities Program.
Well, that's not a mouthful.
No, it's not. But the short version of it is that's how the state is deciding to spend some of this money. And Fresno, having very poor air quality and high poverty levels, is a prime target for this. And so the mayor stepped to the microphone last week and said, look, this is a big opportunity for downtown Fresno. And that's really where she's thinking about starting to focus some of this money.
No less than 50% means no less than $70 million of the $140 million program statewide would have to be spent here in the city of Fresno. This is a huge accomplishment for our community. These dollars can be spent for revitalization, for projects that would help support cleaning our air, building our local economy, and improving the quality of life in the heart of our city, which, as we know, is desperately in need of repair.
And that's still a little vague, right? She's opening the door. They want to keep their options open for what they see as the potential uses for this money. There's like a funding gap that's kind of holding downtown Fresno back a little bit, whereas the private money might be there, but they need a little bit of a boost to kind of get the ball rolling. And when pressed for more specifics about what she sees this $70 million going to, she elaborated on the program, on what it can be used for, like this. Some of the ideas:
pedestrian improvements, transit, support for additional housing, mixed-use development, green space, really just all the ingredients that are needed to create a quality neighborhood and really perpetuate revitalization in our urban core.
Now, this is all money that's coming from cap and trade, the market that the state established for essentially pollution credits, emissions reductions credits, companies that may have a factory and it's going to emit excess CO2 pollution can purchase credits, reductions from on the open market from another company. The state has been doing this for a while now. The most recent auction actually brought in a lot less money than was initially anticipated. So I guess it remains to be seen exactly how much money the state brings in. But high-speed rail has already been receiving some of this cap and trade money. The mayor and the governor talked about high-speed rail, but this is different than that funding, correct?
That's absolutely correct. This is high-speed rail adjacent. So this is for the things that are going to go around high-speed rail, for the businesses that are going to want to move into the ground floor of these multi-use buildings, for bus rapid transit to get to and from the high-speed rail depot. So the thinking here is you want to create a critical mass of projects that are going on to really get the ball rolling downhill. It's these projects, and the mayor talked about this a lot, how previously the money had been heavily siloed into individual little things. Whereas if you put everything all together, you can get a critical mass of projects going that might get a lot more activity and a lot more basically amenities for people in Fresno or people who come to Fresno than would have been there in the past. It's also being pitched as something of a jobs opportunity. Dr. Joaquin Arambula, who's the representative from the 33rd Assembly District that covers Fresno, was one of the main players in his short time in getting this bill approved. And he talked about how this can be an opportunity for people to find good-paying jobs.
This is a brighter day. We can all breathe a little bit easier because this public investment will allow private industry to see a vision for our city. We are starting to have our disadvantaged communities being placed as a priority in our state. It is time for business to look at this investment from public investment to see a plan and a vision that they can all follow. Because it is important for our inner cities, our most disadvantaged communities, to be put back to work, and these dollars will be a path forward for us.
And that's something that the supporters of the train have talked about a lot. Like, once we get this train in place, the high-speed rail train, all these other projects will suddenly become viable where they haven't been viable before.
Now, Joaquin represents parts of Fresno, but he also represents rural areas around the community, and some of those are some of the most polluted and disadvantaged places in the state, even more so than perhaps downtown Fresno. Was there any talk about efforts in those rural areas to try to fund projects there, or is this money specifically for the city of Fresno?
This is money specifically for the city of Fresno. There are other programs going on to help rural communities, but this money specifically is for Fresno, and in the mind of the mayor and the assembly member and other people that have talked about this, they really want to focus on that high-speed rail depot downtown area. They think that there's a lot of opportunity to use this money in effective ways to generate change that otherwise, if you spread it out in a more even peanut butter kind of way, that it would be not as useful as if you target it and really focus on the downtown neighborhood.
Now, of course, the high-speed rail project, perhaps one of Governor Brown's biggest legacy initiatives, and there's all sorts of questions about high-speed rail, which we don't have time to get into today. But when it comes to Governor Brown, he's really seeing this as another one of those legacy pieces, correct?
Oh, yeah. The cap-and-trade program, even though he didn't create it, is definitely he's taken it on as sort of his baby. Gets a lot of criticism over whether or not it's an effective way to do things, over how the credits are being spent. And I think this is a reorientation of the state to kind of address some of those criticisms, which are that the companies weren't spending the money in ways that really helped California.
Yeah, so they were in the past, some of these pollution credits were actually funding things outside of California. Is that happening?
Yeah, and it just seemed like that the businesses were sort of gaming the system and that we as Californians weren't benefiting in ways that we probably should have. So on reauthorizing cap and trade and bills like the one that Assemblymember Arambula worked on, part of that goal was to refocus and be more specific about, okay, we're bringing in this money, we got to do something with it. And Governor Brown talked about how, since we're focusing in California, it can really benefit places like Fresno in California.
So this is a bill that aims to fix up the air, make things better, more livable for everybody. And that's good, because we are what we breathe and what we eat and all the rest of it. Secondly, though, with the cap and trade and the other things we're doing, it actually creates real jobs. It's spending money. It's taking from the people who can't clean up the air the way they need to under the law, that they pay certain credits and allowances, and then that money becomes available. And those are good jobs.
And so that was somewhat an inelegant way of saying what you were getting at, which is that they're looking at the people who are polluting the air and seeing, hey, if they're going to do this damage to our public good, the air quality, what is it that we can get back in exchange for that?
And as Jeffrey Hess joins us today talking about this new effort to put $70 million into projects in Fresno, you mentioned high-speed rail. Also next to this, bus rapid transit, the Fulton Mall project. Any coincidence there?
Oh, no coincidence at all. That's absolutely what they're intending. The long-term vision is that people will be able to come and go outside of cars, as we talked about, that there will be these buildings that are right now largely blighted and empty, can be revitalized. You can put new office space in there. You can put new apartment complexes in there. You can do ground floor retail. So that's, again, back to why he was on top of the parking garage 2 weeks ago, looking down on what could be the next big urban hub in the state of California.
It's a big if. We'll be following the story over the next years, maybe decades, to see how it plays out. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess joining us today to talk about the new cap and trade money that's coming to Fresno. The mayor hopes it's going to help revitalize downtown and clean up the air, not to mention reduce CO2 pollution. We'll see what happens. Jeffrey Hess, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Tomorrow night, the Fresno Art Museum plays host to a special event presented by Cal Humanities. It's part of their On the Road series of events bringing together thought leaders from across the state in a variety of different disciplines. The event in Fresno is very important and relative to our main industry in Central California, agriculture. It's called the Farm Worker Movement in California from Chavez onwards. Joining us now to talk about the event is Pulitzer Prize winner Miriam Powell on how the farm worker movement of the past can help inform the future. Miriam, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
There's a perception out there that the farm labor movement ran out of steam after Cesar Chavez died. Is that accurate?
I think that it's accurate, but it's more accurate to say that it ran out of steam long before he died, actually. It ran out of steam sometime in the mid-early 1980s. And really, by the time he died in 1993, there was not much going on. There were very few union contracts left, and that situation has persisted to this day. There have been many changes in the labor market and also in the regulatory system and so on, but the bottom line is that a lot of the gains that were achieved, at least in terms of the unionization of farm workers, evaporated long ago.
So why did that happen? Why did you see that change? Because certainly the UFW had a very strong voice in the 1970s and in the late 60s. And then, as you said, things changed. Why is that?
You know, it's a complicated story, and there were a lot of factors. The sort of shorthand bottom line is that Chavez himself took the movement in a very different direction and made a lot of decisions toward the end of the 1970s and the early 1980s that really weakened the labor movement part of the UFW per se. And so a lot of the best organizers and the strongest people left at that point and went on and did other things, so that there was a lot of turmoil back now 40 years. And a lot of it really stems from the passage of the Agricultural Labor Relations Act in 1975. Then Governor Jerry Brown made it a priority to make California the only state in the country that has a system that actually sets out a mechanism for farm workers to petition to join a union and to have protected union rights because they're excluded under the National Labor Relations Act. And so that was a big victory and led to a lot of elections and a lot of activity and a lot of leadership growing out of the fields. But at the same time, it very much sort of changed the nature of the union and the movement. And sort of that prompted a lot of change. But I think one of the things that I would like, and I think that this discussion tomorrow will focus on, is what were the tactics that Chavez and the movement used back in the years when they did have so much success against, you know, enormous odds, and what kinds of real basic community organizing tactics they used, and how are those relevant today? both in terms of farm workers and, you know, increasingly a lot of the rest of the economy resembles the conditions that, that farm workers were in and faced back then, as we see sort of this, you know, increasing gig economy, and farm labor contractors are back and forth, but so are many other kinds of middlemen and contractors in everything from Uber to technology jobs and so forth. So I think that, that history can kind of guide us in looking at both the successes and the failures of the farm worker movement, and what can people who are looking to take on the system or change or address income inequality today learn from what happened back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s.
Now, speaking of this event, tomorrow night you'll be joined on stage by Luis Valdez, co-founder of El Triacho Campesino, as well as Don Mabalon and Samuel Orozco from Radio Bilingüe. About this event, you mentioned looking at those tactics. What are they, some of them at least?
You know, what was enormously important about what Chavez did was to empower the poorest people and sort of teach them how, by joining together in very basic community organizing ways and tactics, with house meetings, with making their demands clear, with, you know, the kinds of things that he began his career doing are going to sound very similar. Their voter registration drives, English clashes, citizenship drives, a lot of the things that we see happening again today. And I know that in the Valley, there is a movement. There was a Faith in the Valley conference a couple of weeks ago where there are groups that are trying to start to replicate that. The labor movement as a whole, as you know, has taken, you know, huge hits in the last few decades, and union membership has declined. And I think people are looking at different kinds of models of how to empower poor people to make demands on a system and to be enfranchised in ways that perhaps they have not been now for some time.
You mentioned a while ago the ALRB. This is a creation of Governor Brown in his first stint in Sacramento. The ALRB has been in the news a lot lately. Is it working as intended? And now you have Governor Brown back in Sacramento. Are you surprised that he has not been more involved in working with the ALRB and trying to change things there?
Well, I think that he has actually done a lot with the ALRB and with OSHA and with other things. I think that he has done a lot to empower, to do what he can in terms of the state, in terms of putting people in positions who are going to enforce the law. The chairman of the ALRB, William Gould, is one of the most respected labor lawyers in the country, was the head of the NLRB under Bill Clinton, and I think the board is doing a lot. It's got an effort right now to try to do education, to send agents out, to reach out to workers just to inform them of their rights, particularly when you have, you know, an increasingly indigenous workforce and people who may not even speak Spanish or English. So the board is trying to do what it can, but the entire system and the board and the law was set up on the assumption that there would be a very active labor union out organizing farm workers. In fact, at the time that the law passed, there were two unions competing, the Teamsters and the United Farm Workers. We went head-to-head for a number of years in elections in the fields, and the Teamsters also had a lot of contracts at that time. So the system was set up to, you know, respond to a situation where you had active unions that were organizing and petitioning for elections. That has not been the case for many years now. There are real limits to what the board can do in terms of initiating activity on behalf of farm workers themselves. I know that there's been a lot of attention to the Garawan case in Fresno, and I think that's sort of still dragging on somewhere in the courts and in the system, right? It may go on for years. But, you know, what was notable about the Garawan case is that's an election that the UFW won, I believe, in 1991, 92. Chavez was still alive. And they, under this sort of quirk and amendment to the law that was passed a few years ago, went back and you know, essentially said, we never had a first contract and we're entitled to have one now. So, you know, just the fact that they we're going back to an election that had been won so many decades ago, I think it also sort of tells you something about the level of activity or the lack thereof.
Not to get too much into the Gruen case right now, because it's a complex nest of stories and things, but how significant is that to the UFW? This is a big contract. It's thousands and thousands of employees, presumably. And we've heard various stories about the union ranks, the current union ranks of the UFW over the years. How significant is that and those workers? How significant are those workers to the future of the UFW itself today?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it would probably double their membership. They have so few members at this point under actual contracts. So, you know, it would be a huge influx for them of dues. They get 3% of the dues of their members. And, you know, that's been very much, of course, an issue in whether the workers really want the union or not, and who knows. But it clearly would be a significant influx of money for them. But I think in terms of their own, you know, influence or reputation or activities, probably not all that central. I mean, they've really positioned themselves as much more of a political lobbying force than a bread and butter, you know, labor union representing workers these days.
As we saw a few years ago, the state implemented new heat safety regulations for farm workers. Then just a few weeks ago, Governor Brown signed a new overtime bill for farm workers. What's next on the agenda of labor groups and lawmakers as these things are also much in the legislative debate, not just in the collective bargaining process, in terms of improving the conditions for farm workers?
Right, absolutely. And a lot of the major things that have been done, as you say, have been done legislatively. And I think parenthetically, that's something that the governor has, you know, paid attention to and also been very careful about what he does and doesn't do. I mean, he also listens to agriculture. He's pretty pretty careful about that. I think that the biggest impact for farm workers is going to be the increase in the minimum wage. That is going to have probably more dollars and cents impact on the workers than anything else that has happened lately. And the overtime bill or law is clearly important symbolically and in terms of establishing the idea that farm workers are not second-class citizens, or not second-class workers, and are subject to the same benefits as any other kind of worker. What it's going to actually mean in terms of dollars is, I think, very unclear, and we'll find out. But there are a lot of questions about how much it's going to actually mean to workers on a dollars and cents basis. The other kind of ironic thing is that the workers who are covered under UFW contracts are going to be exempt from the new overtime provisions because of the way the state labor law works. So they will not actually be the beneficiaries, although they were the big lobbyists for it. So I think that you'll continue to see measures that try to legislatively use the mechanism of the state to improve health and safety and working conditions for farm workers, and that will certainly be the direction that some of the advocacy groups like CRLA and others work for as well. You know, I should say wage theft, I think, is going to be the big focus. There is tremendous problems, and there's been lots documented about this, where not only in farm workers, but lots of low-wage jobs and service industries, that wage theft is an enormous problem.
Miriam Pavel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, has studied the life of Cesar Chavez. She is part of a panel discussion taking place tomorrow night at the Fresno Art Museum from Cal Humanities as part of their On the Road series. It's called The Farmworker Movement in California from Chavez Onwards. It also features playwright and co-founder of El Teatro Campesino, Luis Valdez, as well as Professor Don Mabalon and Samuel Orozco of Radio Bilingue. 7 p.m. tomorrow night at the Fresno Art Museum. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Here's the story of a family farm. A different kind of family farm, though. A kind of mom-and-pop operation where everyone gathers around the table after the harvest to share a meal. Except this farm grows marijuana. And the couple that run it are worried about their fate if Prop 64 passes this November, making recreational pot legal. Will it squeeze out the little guys if bigger corporate farms try to make it rich in a green rush? Or will there be a boost in business for small farmers like them? Reporter Sam Harnett got a rare invitation to visit their pot farm and brings us this story as part of our California Counts election collaboration.
This row is a row of random seed strains.
Crystal Ortiz Beck is showing me her farm, or grow as it's known around here. She's pointing out different cannabis strains she and her husband cultivate for medical marijuana dispensaries.
This greenhouse is all OG Kush. This greenhouse is all Girl Scout cookies.
Crystal's grow is in Holmes, an unincorporated town in Humboldt County, right off the 101. The South Fork of the Eel River drifts through this valley. It's sparsely populated and laced with redwood trees. Like much of Humboldt, marijuana has replaced logging as the main livelihood. Crystal says most of the people here have grown for decades, but they've hidden it, and for good reason.
My family was from northern Mendocino County, and we were raided in the pot wars in 1982.
Crystal says her parents would have never been public about their cannabis. And up until a few months ago, even she would have never grown marijuana out in the open. And she definitely wouldn't have invited an outsider like me to visit the farm. But times have changed.
We're moving into the full sun, out of the trees and out of the shadows and into the full sun.
Crystal's husband, Noah Beck, is dragging a cart through their little farm. It's small, less than an acre, and fenced off from the road. They've got several dozen plants outside and in greenhouses. And this grow is legal. They've gotten permits under new regulations Humboldt established last February. Crystal says young growers like her are embracing this new openness.
Whereas the old timers are like, nope, I remember when the feds came in and they took all the 99 plants in Mendo.
That's Mendocino, another county in the Emerald Triangle of marijuana cultivation. Crystal says many older growers here actually oppose the initiative that would legalize recreational marijuana. They worry Prop 64 will bring costly regulations for how cannabis is grown, and that large corporations will start cultivating, which will drive down the price of marijuana. In the last 15 years or so, Crystal says the price has already fallen from $4,000 a pound to $1,500 a pound.
I think they definitely feel like, you know, Budweiser and Coors and big tobacco and big alcohol coming in are going to, and big ag coming in are going to wipe us off the map. And, I mean, that's a very valid concern.
Noah, this is Sam.
Hi.
Hi,
Sam. How are you?
Cool. I'm great. Nice to meet you. Yeah, thanks nice for having me you. Over.
For sure.
Crystal and her husband, Noah, have a plan to stay in business. And it starts with growing small-batch, organic, high-grade marijuana. Or as they call it, connoisseur cannabis. Noah is spraying his plants, not with pesticides, instead seed oil and Dr. Bronner's soap. Noah loves the cannabis plant. It supports his whole family. He shows me the tiny, hairy flowers on a 6-foot plant.
If these hairs are really looking lush and white and full and thick and sticking up towards the sun, and these leaves are sticking way up and stoked, then I know they're fat and healthy, you know? And the crystal formation is coming on.
Noah says to make a living with marijuana these days, you need to do more than just sell great weed. He and Crystal want to make their farm a destination for tourists, like a vineyard, but for cannabis.
You know, a place where you can sit down and have a nice lunch and, you know, enjoy a smoke, a glass of wine, maybe stay the night in a little house.
Bud and breakfast, that's the key name for that.
Right now, Crystal and Noah can't sell their medical marijuana directly to customers, only to dispensaries. Their bud and breakfast dream would be way easier if California voters legalized recreational marijuana, like they may do this fall with Prop 64. Yet, if marijuana is legal, Crystal worries big corporations will get into the business and snuff out the local culture built around cannabis.
I'm not really for the prostitution of the plant. I'm not for the commercialization of the plant.
Crystal says many growers up here are used to a life off the grid. They aren't good at following regulations and working with the law. She fears many won't have the business sense, the money, or the inclination to compete on a larger scale. So, will she vote to legalize?
You know, I would say no, but I'll probably vote for it.
Right.
So, only because I feel like some lightning bolt will come down and strike me out of the sky if I vote against legalization.
At night, Crystal, her husband Noah, their kids, and a few helpers from the farm eat dinner outside on a big picnic table. Then around a campfire, Noah and Crystal pack a bowl and smoke. Someday soon, they hope tourists will be pulling off the highway to come and join them. I'm Sam Harnett in Humboldt County.
Ansel planted it.
The Fresno Philharmonic Orchestra has a big task ahead of it, selecting what will soon be its eighth musical director in the history of the orchestra. Here to tell us more about the process and the upcoming season, which begins this weekend, we have Stephen Wilson of the orchestra, who joins us now. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's great to be here and great seeing your new studios. Congratulations. Well,
thank you very much. Also, congratulations to you, as this is a very big time for the orchestra. You have six candidates who are about to visit Fresno over the next 9 months or so to perform with the orchestra, to do all sorts of community events, and it's really the audition process to find out who will be the next conductor and music director for the orchestra. How did you get down to these six people? Let me start with that.
Right. Yeah, this is actually, this is the final and very public phase of a search process that's actually been going on for quite a while. We opened the search back in March of 2015, and we received 105 applications from conductors from around the world. It was a very, very large and very impressive pool of candidates. Our search committee then started working behind the scenes to winnow that field down to, we had determined that we were going to have six finalists because that's the number of Masterworks concerts that we typically do in a season. The search committee is made up of members of the board of directors, members of the orchestra. We also had one outside representative from the music department of Fresno State, Dr. Anna Hamry. And so they worked very hard reading through 105 applications. We then went through review of video of the candidates conducting, and we did eliminations to get the field down to a semifinal group of, I think it was about 15 or 16 candidates who we did Skype interviews with, and from that group then we chose our final six.
So what are you looking for in the next conductor, in the next music director? If you had to talk about this person as if they're behind a curtain, sort of your ideal candidate.
Right. Well, first and foremost, a great conductor and musician. That's absolutely non-negotiable. That's the one criteria that everyone agrees on. And so that was something that's absolutely something that we are looking for. I think beyond that, we're looking for someone who can articulate a compelling artistic vision for the Fresno Philharmonic, particularly as a 21st century orchestra in this community. We are also looking for someone who is an effective advocate both for our organization, but also too for the art form as a whole. Someone who can speak to the challenges of presenting classical music and trying to get people interested and enthusiastic about what we're doing, who might not have thought they were. And so those would be the key things. And I think, in terms of internally looking for someone who, you know, we think will work effectively with our board, staff, with the musicians, will work well in this community.
So how does the process exactly work? Because you have to take great lengths to be fair and be equal with all of these, even though that they're spread out over 9 months and in different circumstances, they aren't all performing the same concert or the same works with necessarily the same musicians in the orchestra even.
Yeah. Well, I guess that started initially with the planning of the schedule for the season and the programming process. We put together our concert calendar as we normally do, getting our dates from Savoyan Theater. And then we gave all of those dates to all six candidates and asked them which ones were they available for. Then in the meantime, we contracted guest artists for each of the concerts. And so that was in a sense a sort of blind process. So then as the candidates were matched to a concert date, that's what paired them to a guest artist. And then at that point, we asked them to submit proposals for two concert programs using that particular instrument for a concerto. And then after receiving those, then we assembled the season out of that. So that was sort of try to have a programming process that allowed them to obviously to choose what their programs would be, but also to be able to assemble a season that would make sense, that we didn't have, you know, four Shostakovich symphonies or something like that. So that was the initial part of trying to set up this process that was going to run from October through April. Other than that, we then tried to set up a sort of template schedule for each week that the candidates are here, which is pretty similar. It's actually they're all going to be doing, you know, very, very similar things. There might be slight variations, but I think the key approach that we were looking for is to try to set up for them what would be a typical week for a music director in Fresno, the week of a concert, so that we would have media appointments, meetings with donors and subscribers, obviously rehearsing and preparing a concert, and so that we would get a chance to sort of see them in relatively real circumstances. How would they work doing this job here?
Sounds like quite a jigsaw puzzle to put together and make it all work.
Yeah, it was quite complicated. It took a lot of planning across our whole organization, and obviously a lot of communication with the candidates. But now that we're actually here, and as I look at it and how it's laid out, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be really exciting for our audience to kind of see this, to get the chance to meet these six amazingly talented conductors. And I think it's going to be now that we're here on the brink of it, I'm really, really excited.
I want to get to the program of all the concerts, and specifically the one that's coming up October 2nd with Samir Patel and guest artist Gabriela Martinez in just a moment. But before we do that, one more question on the candidates. One interesting thing about Maestro Cuchar when he was with the orchestra is he worked all throughout the world, but he kept his home in Fresno. Would you anticipate that you would see a similar arrangement with a future conductor? Would you want the conductor to have their home base in Fresno? Because almost all of these people have many other jobs throughout the world.
Right. Well, it's certainly the case that whoever the next music director is will be spending a significant amount of time in Fresno, whether or not that's their primary residence. And because the various candidates are in very different situations in terms of where they are currently living, where their other positions are now, we didn't set a hard and fast rule saying that it was necessary immediately to become a resident of Fresno to take the position. There are lots of ways of managing that. And I think the key thing is that regardless of where else a candidate may be living and working, that certainly we will hire someone who has the time and space and inclination to spend enough time here to be a real presence, and also I think a real leader in this community.
Now, we plan to have all of the candidates on air here at Valley Public Radio so our listeners can learn a little more about them. Tell us about Samir Patel and this first concert that's coming up on Sunday.
Yeah, well, Samir Patel is a very, very exciting young conductor who's currently the associate conductor of the San Diego Symphony. That's he was assistant conductor and has just within the past week or so been promoted to associate conductor. Prior to that, he had been associate conductor in Fort Wayne, and he grew up in Michigan, and so is definitely one of the up-and-coming young conducting talents in this country. And he's assembled, I think, a wonderful concert program that's a really terrific opening to the season. What I liked about his program proposal is that he's starting the concert with a work by a contemporary American composer, Jonathan Leshnoff. And so that's a piece called Starburst, which was written several years ago, but I know is being performed quite a bit by orchestras across the country. And so I think that's really terrific. That meant a lot to him to signal immediately he wanted to, you know, program something by a contemporary composer. And then the program we have Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20, a work that hasn't been performed by us in many, many years. And so that's just terrific to be doing a Mozart Piano Concerto. And then Sibelius's wonderful Symphony No. 2, which is just a great romantic masterpiece that I think you know, is just will really show off the orchestra well, and will definitely show off Samir's talents as a conductor.
And you go from there to another concert in November, November 6th, featuring Camille Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony.
Yeah. Again, another work that hadn't been performed here. I believe it has been performed in the past, but quite some time ago. That's interesting, too. One of the aspects of the programming process, we did send all of the candidates a list of what repertoire the Philharmonic had performed in the last 15 years or so, and so I think a number of them really looked for pieces that maybe hadn't been heard in Fresno in quite a while. So that's a work that presents an interesting production challenge for us. We will be bringing an organ into the Soroyan Theater, and so that's really exciting. And so that'll be a great sort of sonic experience for the audience.
And that's with conductor candidate Daniel Meyer, and also performing works by Beethoven and Shostakovich. Then you continue, as we only have a few minutes left here, continue on January 22nd with Alexander Micklewaite.
Yeah, and Alexander, he's again also chosen to have a work by a contemporary American composer, Mason Bates's
Mothership.
Mothership, yes. So that's again another really exciting, very accessible piece of contemporary music, and then finishing up with the Symphonie Fantastique, which will again be another sonic blockbuster.
Definitely, and then a concert of American composers coming up with the event February 19th, and you've got Gershwin and Copland on headlining that one. Tell us about your candidate.
Yeah, and that's the conductor Aram Demirjian, who when he applied for our search, he was associate conductor at the Kansas City Symphony and has just recently been named as music director of the Knoxville Symphony, and so again another very much up and coming young American conductor, and he's chosen again a wonderful and I think, you know, somewhat unusual program that he we threw him a clarinet soloist, the wonderful Anthony McGill, who's the principal clarinet of the New York Philharmonic, and so Aram sort of built the program around Copland's Clarinet Concerto, which is a wonderful, very jazzy piece, and so it was really nice to then put Gershwin on the program and then a symphony by Dvorak, who also has very strong connections with American music.
And we have two more to go here. March 19th, this time featuring the music of Tchaikovsky and also Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5. Tell us about your candidate on that day.
Yeah, and that's Ray Hotoda, who's associate conductor at the Utah Symphony. And again, her program opens with another contemporary piece by the Chinese-American composer Zhu Long, The Rime of Taigu, and then has the Beethoven Emperor's Concerto with Shai Wozner, a pianist who's played with the Fresno Philharmonic before and has appeared on the keyboard concert series at Fresno State, a wonderful pianist, and will just do an outstanding job with the Beethoven and then the ever-popular Tchaikovsky No. 5.
Yeah, and then you close out this season of Masterworks concerts with works by Antonin Dvorak, Ravel, and Stravinsky, and a name that has actually performed with the Fresno Philharmonic in recent years, and your candidate, Jose Luis Novo.
Yeah, Jose Luis Novo, who appeared as a guest conductor with the Philharmonic two seasons ago, and so then I guess was positively enough impressed by the orchestra that he threw his hat in the ring as a candidate after that. And so he's assembled a program which has an interesting thematic interconnection that it pays tribute to the 150th anniversary of the painter Marc Chagall. And so doing several pieces that Chagall either designed sets for opera productions like The Magic Flute or Stravinsky's Firebird, and so making a sort of connection to visual arts through that program.
And of course, there's also the Pops concerts and much more. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Stephen Wilson, we're looking forward to Sunday's concert and to all of the candidates coming to the Central Valley, and looking forward to talking to all of these people and learning more about what makes them tick. We wish you the best.
Thanks so much, Joe. It's great to be here.
All right. That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. Talk@kvpr.org. Send us an email. Also, send us a tweet @KVPR. For Valley Edition, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.